and pacified Charleston, South Carolina, the Hutchings government immediately made SATCOM contact with U.S. Navy logistics ships worldwide, ordering them to return to the U.S. Their remaining cargoes, they were told, were needed to resupply the Army. The ports of Wilmington and Savannah were opened soon after. And once the Army had reached the Gulf Coast, another SATCOM call went out to the UN, letting them know that several ports were available for ships carrying peacekeeping troops and vehicles. This accelerated the arrival of UN troops, which previously had been just a trickle on aircraft landing at McConnell, Tinker, Charleston, and Pope Air Force bases. The reopening of the seaports allowed huge numbers of UN troops to enter the United States. Sarawiwa, Belize, September, the second year. 5 months after he came to convalesce at the Morris house, and just as he was starting to feel that he was fully regaining his strength, Andy became ill after dinner. He had a high fever, sweats, and a stomachache. He had all the signs of a bad flu, but then a rash formed on his chest and his legs. Skin eruptions broke out in his armpits. His wrists started to ache. Andy had never felt so sick in his life. Darcy Mora recognized it immediately. "It's the breakbone." Andy turned his head to look at Darcy and asked, "What? How could a broken bone cause this?"
"No, no, no. Not your broken leg. Nothing to do with that. This is a fever. Breakbone fever. The dengue fever. The people call it breakbone fever because it gives you such pain in the joints."
Andy was very ill. His feverish periods would last for 10 hours or more, and he became delirious. The pain in his muscles and joints became intense. Tylenol kept the pain just barely manageable. A few times, he was given Tylenol with codeine. He had 3 days of diarrhea and vomiting. During one of his lucid periods, Mora explained that dengue fever was caused by a virus transmitted from person to person by the Aedes mosquito, and that there was no specific treatment. Andy asked Darcy,
"Should I go back to the hospital?"
"No. Unless you get much worse and need an IV, the treatment would be the same there, fluids and rest. I'll just keep checking your vitals. There is something called dengue shock syndrome. That's the real killer. But it is not very common. You just have to let your immune system fight this."
After 10 days, the worst of the illness had passed, but Andy still felt miserable. Following Darcy's advice, he drank lots of water. He complained of an odd taste in his mouth, almost as if he were sucking on a zinc lozenge. His recovery from dengue fever was slow. He spent many hours in bed, feeling weak. He read his Bible a lot. Whenever he felt depressed, he read the book of Job, just to put his own minor troubles in perspective. To improve his limited command of Spanish, Andy would often do parallel readings, verse by verse, from his King James Bible and Mora's Santa Biblia, Spanish edition. Andy would often read his favorite verses aloud, such as a portion of Psalm 119.
"Thou art my hiding place and my shield. I hope in thy word. Depart from me, ye evildoers, for I will keep the commandments of my God. Uphold me according unto thy word, that I may live, and let me not be ashamed of my hope. Hold thou me up, and I shall be safe, and I will have respect unto thy statutes continually. Thou hast trodden down all them that err from thy statutes, for their deceit is falsehood. Thou puttest away all the wicked of the earth like dross. Therefore I love thy testimonies."
The Mora's pet green parrot named Payasito kept Andy entertained as he recovered. Andy asked for the bird to be brought to his room so frequently that Gabe eventually moved his cage to Andy's bedside, saying simply,
You two can keep each other company from now on.
Lane joked that Payasito was teaching him his Spanish vocabulary. When I go to restaurants, people will wonder why I always order peanuts, he added in an imitation of a parrot voice.
Cacahuetes, por favor.
Eventually, Andy was able to return to his exercise regimen and began helping Gabe with his work. Gabe still hunted frequently, both to supply his own household with meat and for extra meat to barter. Andy became his skinning and butchering assistant. Mora mostly hunted the native gibnut, a large guinea pig-like rodent, more commonly called a paca or tepezcuintle, or more properly the lowland paca. He also hunted peccaries, deer, armadillos, iguanas, and tapirs. Gabriel liked gibnut hunting best. They were good eating and always plentiful. He jokingly called them the Queen's Rats, referring to when Queen Elizabeth famously ate gibnut when she visited Belize. That dinner prompted a British newspaper to run the headline, Queen Eats Rat. Mora told Andy that these fast-breeding rodents could be found in large numbers throughout the country. Gabe prided himself on always shooting them in the head so that he didn't waste any meat. He rarely missed his mark. Mora owned two 22 rimfire rifles, a Taurus 22 revolver, a 303 Lee Enfield rifle that had been sporterized, and two shotguns. His better 22 rifle was a scoped Marlin. All of this gun's metal parts and its scope had been spray-painted green to help protect it from rust in the unrelenting humidity. The paint often flaked, and it showed signs of being touched up. This was Mora's gibnut gun. When Andy asked if his guns were registered, Gabe chortled and said,
"No, no way. I think only about half the guns in the country are in the registry. That registry is a big joke, especially out in the bush. Some of those guys have full-on AKs and old submachine guns from the Second World War that aren't registered."
Andy began going on hunts with Mora. On these hikes, Gabe tried to teach him the names of the local tree species, but they soon became a confusing blur. The old logger mentioned that there were more than 700 species in Belize, and that he knew the names of only half of them. Andy finally said,
"Well, it is more important that I know how to buy food and ask directions in Spanish than it is to know the name of every tree."
Andy often quoted the Bible to Gabe, who had been raised as a Catholic, but who was relatively ignorant of the scriptures. He once told Andy,
"I haven't gone to Mass or confessed in years. I worked so much in those backcountry camps that I got out of the habit. God wouldn't want me."
But Andy reassured him, saying,
"All you need is faith in Christ Jesus. That's the way, the only way, to heaven. Believe in him and repent. It's just that simple."
Lane regularly encouraged Mora to read his Bible. He also prayed daily that Gabe and Darcy would come back into fellowship. On one of their longer hunting excursions, Gabe showed Andy his secret stash of gasoline, buried in the side of a small ridge at his uncle's wooded property, 3 miles west of Sarawiwa. Mora described his fuel storage technique to Lane. When he was working as a backcountry logger, he had discovered that gasoline, stored in 33-gallon plastic drums with the bungs sealed tight, was still usable for up to 4 years, even without the addition of a stabilizer. Stored the same way, diesel would last much longer if it was treated with an antimicrobial. The food-grade blue drums that Gabe used for his gasoline had white gaskets in the bungs that swelled slightly but did not deteriorate. These blue plastic drums were stored inside 55-gallon steel drums and shaded from direct sunlight. A dark green tarp was draped over the pair of drums. Mora found that the plastic drums expanded and contracted with the fuel as the temperature changed. With no air venting, the problems of water condensation, evaporation, and other contaminants were solved. And, he surmised, in the event that the 33-gallon drum ever burst unexpectedly, the fuel would be contained within the larger steel drum. It was on that same trip that Mora bagged the first iguana that Andy had ever seen in the wild. Mora stopped the big lizard with just one shot to the back of its head from his Marlin 22 rifle. This iguana was more than 3 feet long. It had a fat tail, which Mora said was a sign of good health. Iguana, called bamboo chicken by the Mora family, was a favorite delicacy. Gabe said that to get his daughter and son-in-law to come visit, all he had to do was tell them that he planned to serve iguana. During his recovery, Andy continued with his weekly HF radio contacts. More than half of them were successful. It was those Morse code conversations with his brother and fiancée that kept his spirits up. Gabe Mora had cut back drastically on his driving after the crunch began, but he would often ride his bicycle to Sarawiwa or even as far away as Dangriga to buy groceries. He would carry his Taurus 22 revolver on those shopping trips. Gabe would frequently spot wild game near the road and bring home some bonus protein. Bloomfield, New Mexico, April, the second year. Lars and Lisbeth Lane spent a lot of time in their ham shack, a corner of their bedroom, on more than just Tuesday nights. They became avid shortwave listeners, doing their best to keep track of current events by scanning through the international broadcast bands, mainly in the high 9 megahertz and high 11 megahertz ranges, listening to radio stations such as the BBC, Radio Netherlands, Radio Havana, Cuba, Channel Africa, HCJB in Ecuador, and NHK in Japan. They also tuned up to 17.795 megahertz to hear Radio Australia. It was disconcerting to hear the litany of very bad economic news, refugee movements, terrorist attacks, and massive riots. It was even more disturbing to notice when some of these radio stations dropped off the air. The Lanes also picked up valuable news listening to amateur radio operators from all over the United States. They had the most success listening to hams in the Rocky Mountain region and just east of the Rockies, but they found that it was more difficult for them to hear hams in the Northeast. At first, Lars assumed this was because of poor propagation or weak signal strength. But then he came to realize that the real reason so few hams were heard in the Northeast was because of the tremendous societal disruption and the lack of power. Most of the time, Lars merely listened to the conversations of other ham radio operators and never used his own microphone. It was only when Kaylee asked him to contact her family near New Braunfels, Texas, that they actually keyed the mic and made contact with a couple of hams. From them, they learned that Kaylee's family was safe and well. He also checked up on Lisbeth's family in eastern Colorado. They learned that her mother had died in a diabetic coma, but that her father and brother were still alive and working at a grain mill. Lars was never successful at checking up on his relatives on his mother's side. The Bardgard family lived in Minnesota, one of the places where the population die-off was severe. There, a combination of harsh winters and relatively high population density combined to produce a huge depopulation. Chapter 32. Social Work. This present window of opportunity, during which a truly peaceful and interdependent world order might be built, will not be open for too long. We are on the verge of a global transformation. All we need is the right major crisis, and the nations will accept the new world order. David Rockefeller, addressing the United Nations Ambassador Dinner, September 14, 1994. Sarawiwa, Belize, February, the third year. To get ready for his upcoming departure, Andy started buying compact backpacking foods and extra batteries for his ham radio and surefire flashlight in Sarawiwa and Dangriga. He also solicited letters of introduction from both Gabe Mora and the consul from the American Embassy. After Andy had declared himself fit to travel, Gabe said,
"I can give you a ride as far as Orange Walk, but first I will make inquiries about horse breeders there. I know that there are several. I'll give you a letter of introduction that you can carry."
At dinner 2 days later, Gabe announced, "I found you a horse breeder. His name is Pedro Hierro, and his ranch is just north of Orange Walk, not far off the Northern Highway. I hear he has some of the best horses in the district." Knowing that he was soon likely to depart, in the privacy of his bedroom, Andy pulled out his Primus stove. Working with a screwdriver, he extracted two of the duct-tape-wrapped 1 ounce gold coins, and then he carefully reassembled the stove heat shield. Andy felt bad that the checks that had been sent to Darcy by the U.S. State Department were worthless, so he gave Gabe his set of bicycle tools and his big Maglite flashlight, explaining that he needed to cut down on weight for his upcoming journey. After some prayer, he also gave Darcy a 1 ounce American Eagle, one of his last few remaining gold coins. As he handed it to her, he said,
"You have been such a blessing. You have always made me feel welcome here, and I have shared your food with your delicious cooking for many months. This is the least that I can do to thank you. I won't take no for an answer."
Their drive to Orange Walk was enjoyable. Gabe pointed out a number of sites and filled Andy in on some details about the history of the country. As they neared Orange Walk, Gabe started pointing out dozens of Mennonite-owned farms. He explained,
"They started moving here in the 1950s. Good folks. When the power grid went down, the old order ones didn't even notice. They don't believe in electricity. But I'm worried about how they'd done when the Guatemalan gangs have come through, because they don't believe in guns either."
He dropped Lane off at the front gate of the horse ranch. A simple, hand-painted sign read, "Pedro Hierro, Excelentes Caballos." The ranch's pastures were enclosed in sturdy, white-painted, welded tubular steel fences that looked like they had taken many hours to construct. A small, stout, cinder-block house overlooked the pastures and a hayfield. Gabe said,
"I should just leave you here. This guy doesn't know me, so I think it's best that you just introduce yourself. He might be more nervous if two of us go up there."
Andy nodded. Seeing that the gate was locked, he climbed over it. Gabe lifted Andy's pack over the gate to him, and Andy shouldered it. They shook hands through the gate, and Morris said earnestly,
"God will see you safely home."
Andy nodded and smiled.
"And you as well. Con Dios, Gabe."
He turned to walk up the hill. He saw that there were more than a dozen mares and nearly as many foals in the pasture to his right. Just below the house was a smaller, one-horse stallion corral. The horse in it was a fine-looking, dark chestnut stallion with a long mane and a gleaming coat. Andy heard Mora's car driving away. An elderly man stepped out on the porch and eyed Lane as he approached. A woman, about the same age, looked on from the open doorway. The man casually cradled a double-barreled shotgun in his arms. Andy waved and shouted,
"Saludos! I want to buy a horse!"
The man thoroughly read both of Andy's letters of introduction. Then, even before talking about his available horses, Pedro Hierro asked Andy how he planned to pay. Andy answered,
"En monedas de oro. Yo tengo un Kruger Rand. It is a 1 ounce coin. Uno onza de oro."
Hierro's eyes brightened, and he urged,
"Come, come and see my horses."
The horses that Pedro Hierro had available for sale were in his back pasture. He whistled them in and shook a partially full bucket of grain. The remuda of nearly 20 horses came at them at a gallop. After they were all in the corral, Hierro deftly closed the gate behind them. Lane was impressed by how quickly he moved for an old man. Andy rested his forearms on the corral's top rail and began to look them over. One of them looked a bit lame, perhaps a hoof problem, but all of the others looked like good, sound horses. There were a few mares, but most of them were geldings.
"Do you have any saddle-broken horses that are extra quiet? Bien callados, tranquilos?"
The old man pointed to a large chestnut gelding that was standing slightly separated from the herd.
"Sí, este caballo que está castrado."
To Andy, the big gelding looked like it had some strong bloodlines, perhaps Andalusian. There wasn't a spot of white on him, which he liked. The gelding appeared to be 16 hands or better. Andy asked its name.
¿Cómo se llama?
Prieto.
After a pause, the horse breeder added,
Prieto es muy tranquilo. He's the most quiet of all my horses. No resopla, no big snorts from this one. Also, no relinchos.
Andy cocked his head and asked,
¿Qué? ¿Qué es relinchos?
The old man explained,
A relincho you calls a whinny.
Ah, muy bueno.
He's well broken for riding?
Sí, señor. He's 4 years old.
Andy climbed into the corral and approached the horse. He looked the horse in the eye. He brushed the side of the gelding's neck and made a soft cooing noise. Then he chanted the horse's name.
Prieto. Prieto.
The horse swung his head around and put his nose below Andy's chin. Lane took a few minutes to scratch the horse on his poll, between his ears and beneath his forelock. The gelding's mouth made a chewing motion in response. Andy examined the horse closely. Andy pointed out some scars and some proud flesh on the horse's right rear flank and gascon. Hierro explained,
Those scars are where he was bitten by another horse when he was young. If not for those scars, I think he would have sold before now. Can I give him a test drive?
The old man laughed and nodded.
Por supuesto.
Andy's test drive lasted more than an hour, with Pedro Hierro riding alongside on his favorite saddle mare. They rode toward the new river. Negotiating the upper banks gave Andy the chance to see that Prieto was confident on steep terrain. Crossing the river twice made it clear that he wasn't afraid of water. The saddle that Andy borrowed was a good fit, although Andy would have preferred a thicker saddle pad. After working out some tack-fitting issues, with one stop early on to adjust stirrup height, and learning the horse's preferred gait, the ride went well. Andy and Prieto quickly developed a bond. The horse was obviously well-trained and had good ground manners. Prieto didn't balk at being ridden over steep ground and rocky spots. He was also just as quiet as the old man had advertised. They returned to Hierro's house at a trot. After they had unsaddled the horses, Andy looked the old man in the eye and said,
I like this caballo. He will do. Here's my offer. I trade you my 1 ounce Krugerrand for your horse Prieto, along with this saddle, this bit and bridle, a pair of hobbles, a lead rope, and also a pair of large saddlebags.
Pedro Hierro nodded slowly and gave a thin smile.
Show me this gold.
When he left Pedro Hierro's rancho the next morning, Andy had all that he had asked for, plus a collapsing canvas bucket, a grooming brush, and a hoof pick. The saddle was soon modified with a leather punch and nylon straps, allowing Andy's backpack to be strapped on behind the saddle deck. An extra-large saddle pad protected the horse from the weight of the backpack on his loins. The pack's position made it awkward for Andy to mount and dismount the horse, but it obviated the need to use a separate pack horse. Andy's goal was to make a small signature when traveling. It was 35 miles from the rancho to the Mexican border. He planned to cross at Santa Elena, just west of the large city of
Chetumal on the Rio Hondo. By evening, he was camped in the jungle near the village of Chanchen, just 4 miles short of the border. He gave the horse more than an hour to graze in a meadow while he ate his own dinner. Chili, straight from the can. Then he led Prieto off into the jungle. Andy hobbled the horse and camped on a small knoll. It was an anxious night for him. He was saddle sore, and he felt cranked up. He desperately wanted to talk with Kaylee, but it was 2 days until his next scheduled contact. After a fitful night in his bivy bag, worrying about both the horse and the upcoming border crossing, he awoke at dawn. He had a breakfast of day-old Johnny cakes and some iguana tail jerky. He was already missing Senora Mora's cooking. Before departing, he repacked his backpack, secreting the pistol and its accessories inside a large bundle of clothes that was secured by string. That went in the bottom of his backpack in the hope that it would be the last thing that would be searched by the customs officers. Crossing the border was easier than he had anticipated. The Santa Elena border station was a simple structure. The sight of his horse passing through was only a little unusual. Leaving Belize, tourists were supposed to incur a $20 exit fee, but this was waived for Andy after a glance at the consul's letter. When he stepped across the line to the Mexican side of the station, his passport check was perfunctory. The Mexican customs agent looked bored as he stamped Andy's new American passport. He just waved Andy through. He had prepared himself by placing a bill of sale and a veterinary health certificate form letter from Hierro, as well as his letters of introduction in the top of his saddlebag. He even had a half-ounce American Eagle gold coin in his pants pocket, ready to palm as a bribe if necessary. He was greatly relieved when it wasn't needed. Just a few miles past the border, Andy led Prieto into some scrub brush out of sight from the road and retrieved his pistol. He positioned the holster in its usual spot on his belt, above his right buttock. He felt more at ease knowing that this SIG was safely cradled there, ready for quick action. It was concealed by his leather vest, which he habitually wore unbuttoned. He kept his horse off the road, following what looked like a motorcycle trail that closely paralleled the highway. The road west toward Romanal was almost deserted. No buses were running, and just a few local ranchers' trucks went by. West of Lago Milagros, Andy could see that he was entering big rancho country. The soil was noticeably more sandy. In places, the sand was snow-white. Barbed wire fences now bordered both sides of the road. Still, the country seemed more like Belize than Mexico. The brush and trees were still the same, only the truck license plates were different. Some of the fences sagged and looked comical, and Lane wondered how well they held cattle. Andy wanted to turn north, but he knew that he first had to travel west for more than a week to skirt around the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. Every day he rode toward the sunset, hoping and waiting for the turn northward. That wouldn't come until he reached Villahermosa, 300 miles to the southwest. Andy hoped to make 35 miles per day, assuming he could find plentiful food and water for his horse. Theoretically, he could be home in New Mexico, 1,750 miles away, in just 2 months, but that was as the crow flies. More realistically, he knew that it would probably take at least twice that long. There were deserts and mountain ranges ahead, and many unknown perils. Traveling entirely at night would in some ways be safer, but he was afraid that he'd stumble into an ambush, and the mosquitoes swarmed by the thousands. It took a heavy application of bug juice to discourage them. Taking pity on Prieto, Lane daubed a bit of insect repellent around the horse's eyes before sleeping each night. He dreaded leaving the mosquito-netted bivy bag each morning. Lane close-hobbled Prieto every night and was pleased to see that the horse rarely wandered more than 10 yards away from the bivouac bag. Some nights, he hardly moved at all. The sound of the horse's breathing and the regular swishing of his tail were comforting, and he hoped that he might give him some warning if a man or jaguar approached the camp. And he even became accustomed to the horse's daily pattern of urination, defecation, and flatulence. Prieto often showed signs of anxiety for the first hour after Andy settled into the bivy bag each night. Then the horse would let loose a ripping fart, let out a loud breath through its nostrils, and finally stand still, often for the full night. This routine made Andy laugh the first few times that he heard it. He got into the routine of grooming the horse twice a day, including picking his hooves. The most time-consuming part was searching for and removing ticks. He'd often find a tick on Prieto's belly or in one of his ears. If the horse shook its head in the middle of the day, Andy would stop, dismount, and check his ears for ticks. This was usually the cause. Andy's first attempt at a radio contact from Mexico was 2 days later, on a Tuesday night. The propagation was so poor that he couldn't even receive Lars's previously strong signal. He gave up in disgust. Prieto tried to linger with his hooves in the water after watering breaks. Andy would have liked to indulge the horse's preference, but he considered it a security risk. After all, creek and river crossings were high-risk ambush areas. He also worried about his horse eating noxious weeds, and made a point of only stopping and letting Prieto graze in grasses that he recognized. Sometimes, the horse would get into a particularly tasty bunch of grass and be reluctant to move on. When that happened, Andy would have to tug quite hard on Prieto's reins, or if he was dismounted at the time, he'd ball up his fist with his thumb extended and dig his thumb into Prieto's chest while ordering him backward with the words, "Hacia atrás!" Despite a few quirky habits, Andy was impressed with Prieto's intelligence and instincts. The horse had particularly good sense about snakes. Several times, Andy would be riding alongside the road at a trot, and suddenly Prieto would come to a dead stop and lay back his ears. Each time there was a snake just a few paces ahead. If the snake was a fer de lance, called a Tommy Goff in Belize, or an unidentified snake species, Andy would simply guide the horse in a large circle around to avoid it. But if it was a large rattlesnake, Andy would dismount and tie up Prieto at a safe distance. Then he'd pin the snake's head down with a branch and decapitate it with his pocket knife. Rattlesnakes were good eating. But Prieto was so frightened of snakes that he'd start to prance in place. Andy learned that the only way that he could get close to Prieto when holding a dead snake was if he first hid it in a sack. Because of the space constraints of his backpack, Andy could only carry 4 or 5 days' worth of food. By the time he reached the town of Escarcega, he was down to his last few bits of food. He saw a sign on a small masonry building with heavily barred windows. Monedas numismático. A sign hanging inside the front window read, "Abierto," showing that the store was open. As Lane dismounted, a boy wearing a large sombrero approached and asked, "Le cuido su caballo?" Andy nodded affirmatively. Andy handed the boy Prieto's reins. Expecting the wait to be 20 minutes, he told the boy, "Aproximadamente 20 minutos." Just like at the coin shop in Germany, Andy had to be buzzed in. The door closed behind him with a loud click. Just inside the door was another door. To his left was a small window where an armed guard sat. The guard glanced through the window at the boy and the horse. Andy asked, "Can that boy be trusted?" The guard grunted,
"Sí, mi chico es de confiar."
Andy saw a sign above that warned that weapons had to be checked. "Registrar todas las armas aquí, sin excepciones." He let out a sigh and muttered, "Okay, your house, your rules." Under the watchful eye of the man, who was armed with an odd, three-barreled antique shotgun, Andy made a show of slowly unholstering his SIG, ejecting its magazine and clearing its chamber, locking the slide to the rear. He passed the pistol butt first through the window and stuffed the magazine and loose cartridge into his front pocket. Then he handed the man both his CRK Tanto folding pocket knife and his Leatherman tool from his other pocket. A second buzzer sounded, and Lane entered the main portion of the coin shop. He was surprised to see the shop was owned by a bald, wrinkled man in a wheelchair. The guard with the shotgun pivoted his stool and closely watched all that transpired. The store was mainly lit by daylight from the windows, supplemented by some strings of white LED lights, the kind that he had previously seen used on Christmas trees. Andy surmised that the lights and door lock were solar-powered. Clever. He asked the man in the wheelchair, "Do you speak English?"
"Yes, I do. Can I be of help to you?"
"I'd like to trade this Krugerrand for silver coins. I want to trade for whatever you think would be best for me to barter for food in my travel. Do you have some silver pesos or maybe Onza de Plata coins? The condition is unimportant to me. My only concern is their silver content." He handed the storekeeper the Krugerrand. It made Andy smile when he saw the coin dealer repeat the same steps to verify the authenticity of the coin that he had seen demonstrated in Germany. Some tools of the trade, he realized, were universal. The man looked up with a smile and declared, "I can give you 48 silver 5-peso coins of before 1958 minting in trade for this coin. I'm sure that you know the 5-peso coins from this time is 72% silver and has 0.6431 of the troy ounce of silver." Andy worked the math in his head. "How about 55 of those? That would be a more fair ratio."
The best I can do in the trade is 52.
Andy nodded and said, "That is acceptable to me, but only if you substitute 10 1-peso silver coins instead of 2 of those 5-peso coins."
"Yes, I can include some of the smaller coins, but they will all be the 1957 silver 1-peso Juarez. These are a very common minting, not much wear on them."
"That is fine. We have a deal." They shook hands. The coin dealer counted out the coins in piles of 5 on a blue, felt-covered tray. Andy confirmed the count. The coin dealer placed them in a small canvas sack that was printed, "First Community National Bank, Brownsville, Texas." Seeing that sack made Andy grin. He was now feeling closer to the United States, and feeling anxious. Andy wished the dealer well as he set aside a handful of 1- and 5-peso coins from the sack. This handful went loose into his pants pocket, while the rest, in the canvas sack, went into his cargo pocket. After retrieving his knives and pistol, Andy reloaded and holstered the SIG. The guard gave Andy a friendly nod. He was buzzed out the front door and found the boy standing there dutifully, still holding Prieto's reins. Lane dug in his pocket and pulled out a silver 1-peso coin. He handed it to the boy and said,
"Una moneda de plata para ti. Gracias por su trabajito."
The boy grinned, shouted,
"Muchas gracias, señor,"
and ran off, singing. There was a bodeguero just 2 blocks farther west. The grocery store was half open air, with 7 rough-hewn tables beneath latticework for shade. 2 bored-looking teenage guards with ancient Mexican Mauser carbines stood watch. The grocery had a surprisingly good selection. Andy bought 2 large bags of beef jerky, carne seca, 12 apples, 5 large carrots, 8 cans of chili con carne, 12 sun-dried Spanish mackerel, 6 cans of chicken noodle soup, 8 big hunk candy bars, and a sack of hardtack that was the size of 2 loaves of bread. After a bit of dickering, a price of 1.5 silver pesos was agreed. His change was a peso coin that had been cold chiseled in half. After seeing the prices asked at the bodeguero, it was now no wonder that the boy had been so excited to get the silver peso. It took a while to pack all the groceries into the backpack and saddlebags. As he did, Andy fed Prieto a carrot that he chomped with gusto. He nosed at Andy, hoping for another, but Andy was saving those for the coming days. His progress through the states of Quintana Roo and Campeche was slow. He did his best to avoid large towns, but he actually did veer towards some small villages. In each, he would always ask,
¿Sabense más adelante, hay bandidos en el camino?
Do you know if bandits await on the road ahead? At the village of La Pita, he got an affirmative response. There, a pot-bellied man warned Andy that a bandit gang controlled the village of Mamantel, just a few miles beyond. He drew Lane a map, showing him a road that skirted around the west side of the village. Andy thanked the man for the warnings and handed him 2 silver pesos with the words,
Unas monedas de plata para ti. Gracias por su advertencia.
Andy waited until after dark to make his circuitous route around Mamantel. The ride was nerve-wracking, but uneventful except for a couple of barking dogs. His journey northward through Mexico soon got into a rhythm. After 20 to 25 miles of riding, Andy would look for some woods or dense brush that would offer a secluded campground. He would scan in all directions, first with his eyes, and then with his binoculars, to see if he was observed. If anyone was present, he'd let Prieto graze, or he'd pick the horse's hooves until the strangers had passed well out of his line of sight. He would then quietly lead Prieto into the woods, usually at least 200 yards or even farther when the woods weren't dense. Camping alone caused Andy lots of anxiety. He was often afraid that he might be observed and followed. Andy's next shopping excursion was in the small city of Macuspana, in the state of Tabasco. The town was in a broad basin that was mostly agricultural, and he found a profusion of fresh produce at great prices. The thatched roof, Centro Mercado, had plenty of flies, but the fruit and vegetables all looked fresh. The best bargain was a large sack of dried fish, enough to last Andy for more than a week. The sack was so large that Andy simply tied it to his saddle horn. Prieto snorted at it at first, but with some gentle correction from Andy, the horse left it alone. Andy decided that it was best to work his way up the Gulf Coast, sticking to small roads. He had considered traveling a more westerly and direct route to New Mexico, but that would mean that water and the opportunities to buy food would be iffy, the terrain more rugged, and the grazing for his horse more uncertain. Traveling cautiously, he averaged only 20 miles per day. He skirted around the larger population centers, like Minatitlan and Veracruz. He wanted to stay as far away from Mexico City as possible, since the city of 8.4 million residents was reportedly chaotic. Andy surmised that many of those problems must have been overflowing into its suburbs and beyond. One Tuesday evening, Andy had a successful HF contact with Lars. He was thrilled to be able to use the call sign 4A/K5CLA, with the 4A prefix designating that he was transmitting from Mexico. The significance of the prefix was immediately apparent to Lars, but it had to be explained to Beth and Kaylee. As usual for his contacts, Andy gave Kaylee a weekly travelog, letting her know the sights he had seen, how he was feeling, and in this instance, a bit about Prieto's eccentricities. That same night, Andy was awakened by a strange commotion. He soon realized that it was Prieto stomping a pygmy rattlesnake to death just a few feet from Andy's head. Andy didn't even bother crawling out of his bivy bag. He just ordered Prieto to back off with, "Hacia! Hacia atrás!" Then he unzipped the bivy bag, picked up the well-trodden snake carcass behind its head, and heaved it as far as he could out of the campground. He zipped the bag back up and said,
"Good night, super horse."
As Andy passed north of Orizaba, the population density increased noticeably. There was more traffic on the roads, with a surprising number of motorcycles and mopeds. Some of the men looked unsavory. Andy had to be much more selective about where he camped. He was increasingly afraid that someone might see where he had ducked into the forest and attack him. He often heard bursts of gunfire in the distance. These shots were too rapid to be just hunters. Obviously, there was a big crime problem in the area, and it was being stamped out ballistically. Near Zempoala, Andy had an amazing conversation with a local teenage boy who spoke good English. The boy was armed with a pump-action .22 rifle slung on his back with a length of white clothesline cord. Andy commented to him about how peaceful things seemed on the coast. The teenager explained,
"That's because it's open season on Los Canibales de la Ciudad. When anyone sees them, they just shoot them. Then we burn or bury the bodies so their friends don't come and eat them. It's all like something from a zombie movie."
"You're kidding, right?"
"No joke, senor.
There have been hundreds from Mexico City, and even some from Xalapa that we've had to kill. If you are ever seeing strangers with knives or machetes, and they have their blood-stained clothes and that look in their eyes, you don't ask questions. Do not hesitate. You just shoot them."
"What look in their eyes?" Lane asked.
"That look. The animal look. You know it when you see it. After the first time, you recognize it immediately."
The boy's comments made Andy shudder. Lane was dubious about what he'd been told until he heard it corroborated by a policeman in the next town. This made him anxious to get as far away from Mexico City as he could, as quickly as possible. Chapter 33.
Avtomat Kalashnikov. Anything that is complex is not useful, and anything that is useful is simple. This has been my whole life's motto. Mikhail Timofeyevich Kalashnikov.
Prieto seemed healthy, and his hooves stayed in good condition. Other than mosquito bites, sand flea bites, and sunburn, Andy was also healthy. After he had gained his saddle muscles, the long days on horseback became more bearable. After skirting Veracruz, Lane hugged the coast. In a few stretches with hard sand, he rode Prieto right on the beach, finding it less stressful than constantly looking over his shoulder, as he did when riding on the shoulder of the road. Occasionally, when the surf was light, he'd let Prieto walk in the shallow waves as they lapped up the beach. The horse liked having his hooves in the water. The beautiful scenery was distracting, and Andy had to try to keep focused at all times. He had to fight to keep himself in at least a condition yellow frame of mind. As he rode down the beach, he would sing to himself and to Prieto. He often sang Jimmy Driftwood's bluegrass song Tennessee Stud and snippets of Mexican folk songs that he had picked up. And whenever Prieto broke into a gallop in the shallow surf, he shouted repeatedly, "I'm coming home, Kaylee! I'm coming home!" The stretch of coast between the towns of Zempoala and Vega de Alatorre had an old Mexico feel to it, and the locals were friendly. Many of them seemed curious about Andy and his horse. There were fewer horses, mules, and donkeys in this region than he had seen inland, so young children would often run toward Prieto gleefully, wanting to see and touch El Caballo Grande. Prieto seemed to put up with it well, but once he snatched a straw sombrero off a boy's head and started chewing it before Lane could stop him.
and he apologized for mi caballo travieso, and gave the boy a silver peso coin. The boys ran off, carrying the mangled hat and the coin, shouting and laughing. Andy was surprised to have the boy's mother return a few minutes later with three quarters of the coin. One quarter of it had been neatly chiseled out, explaining,
"You have paid off my son too much for his sombrero."
As he moved up the coast, Lane's diet shifted toward bananas, coconuts, and dried fish. There were so many coconuts available, free for the taking, that he cracked open several extra ones each day. After drinking their milk, he scraped out the insides with his pocket knife and gave the pulpy coconut meat to Prieto, who licked it up eagerly. Not wanting to make a wide detour around some lakes, Andy opted to ride directly through the city of Tampico. Knowing that it would be a full day's ride to get through Tampico and the many small towns clustered to the north of it, Andy decided to camp earlier than usual. He let Prieto graze an extra long time in a meadow that was a comfortable 400 yards from the highway. Later, as he set up his camp in the middle of a large grove of coconut trees, Andy remembered an old Stan Kenton big band tune that he had heard as a child, played on one of his grandmother Bardgard's 78 RPM records. It was called Tampico. He sang quietly to himself,
"Ay, Tampico, Tampico, on the Gulf of Mexico. Tampico, Tampico, down in Mexico. You buy a beautiful shawl, a souvenir for Aunt Flo, authentic Mexican yarn, made in Idaho. Oh!"
Hearing Lane singing, Prieto gave him a snort. Andy chided the horse to be quiet.
"Cállate, Prieto! Tú no resoples!"
Andy carried on, but just humming, since he couldn't recall the rest of the song's lyrics. The ride through Tampico the next day was unnerving. By 10 a.m., the temperature was already in the 90s. As near as Andy could tell, several gangs controlled the city and the surrounding towns. Individually and in pairs, he saw a few men armed with a diverse assortment of AKs, bolt-action rifles, HKG-3s, M-16s, M-4, and pump-action shotguns. A few of them had neck tattoos that reminded him of the Guatemalans who had robbed him. This made Andy very nervous. Thankfully, none of the men ever tried to intercept his horse. Several times while riding through Tampico, boys on bicycles would ride up next to Andy and ask one-word color questions like, "Rojo? Azul? Negro?" At first, Andy didn't understand them and shrugged in response. Then he came to realize that they were asking Andy about his gang affiliation. He decided to bluff them by shouting,
"El Fortissimo! Vayanse, chiquillos!"
The strongest. Go away, kids. Andy didn't start to relax that day until he had ridden north of the town of Ricardo Flores Magón, late in the afternoon. He was happy to be away from the Tampico gangland. After passing through several coffee plantations, Lane camped that night in a dense grove of trees, 100 yards up from a river. The hillside was steeper than he liked, but all of the level ground in the area had long since been cleared of trees. The moon was starting to wane, but was still nearly full. Andy drifted off to sleep, stuffed full of wild bananas. He was awakened by a snort from Prieto. Lane sat halfway up in his bivy bag and listened. He could hear something moving through the undergrowth, 20 yards downhill from his camp. In the moonlight, Andy could see Prieto standing just 10 feet away, with his nose pointing downhill. The horse's ears were alternating between being perked up and laid back. He was obviously wary about something. Andy's first thought was that it might be a jaguar. Then Andy heard a cough, a human cough. Lane slowly unzipped his bivy bag's no-see-um netting and pointed his SIG pistol in the direction where he had heard the noises. Only his head and forearms protruded from the bag. Realizing that making any sound could prove fatal, he decided not to move. He couldn't further extricate himself from the bag without making noise. Listening intently, he could identify the sounds of two people walking up the hill. Soon Andy could see that two figures were climbing the hill, coming directly toward Prieto. As they climbed up closer, Andy began to see some details. Both were muscular young men. Both were shaved, bald-headed. One of them was wearing a white tank top. The other was wearing a white T-shirt. Both of them carried AK-47s and small rucksacks. Andy was uncertain if they might be local ranchers or coffee growers. When they were just 5 yards away, he could see that they were both looking at his horse. They hadn't yet detected Andy, who was sitting in a spot that was shaded from the moonlight. As they stepped closer, one of them shouldered his rifle and thumbed down its safety lever with a loud clack. It was then that Andy could see that they both had tattoos covering most of their arms and ringed around their necks. Andy lined up the glowing green sights of the SIG on the head of the man who had raised the AK and pulled the trigger through twice rapidly. The bandit went down instantly. Then he quickly shifted his sights to the other man, who was turning to point his rifle toward Andy's muzzle flashes. Andy fired rapidly 5 more times at the chest of the second man. He, too, went down, shouting. Andy took careful aim and shot each of the men twice more in the head. The shooting startled Prieto, and he shifted backward, dragging his hobbled front hooves in an odd jump. The horse snorted anxiously. The two bandits continued to thrash on the ground, bleeding out. A dog barked far in the distance, perhaps a half mile away. Andy fumbled in his sleeping bag, searching for a spare magazine. Finding it, he ejected the one in his gun and slapped in the spare. He tapped the butt of the pistol twice with his free hand, ensuring that the magazine was correctly latched in place. He was gasping, and he fought to control his breathing. After a minute, the two bandits finally stopped moving. He quietly wormed his way out of the bivy bag. His ears were ringing and his hands were shaking. Were there others? If so, how far away? Should he sit tight or flee? He decided to wait and listen. He waited for a very anxious half hour, hearing only the quiet sounds of Prieto breathing and the occasional high whine of mosquitoes. He prayed silently, and then decided that it was time to go. He holstered his pistol, and then, after rolling and stowing his bivy bag, groped around until he retrieved the partially expended pistol magazine. He made a mental note to refill it when he had daylight available. Moving quietly, but quickly, he saddled and tacked up Prieto, but he left the horse's hobbles on for fear of him running off. He rubbed the horse's neck consolingly and whispered in his ear,
"Bueno, Prieto, muy bueno, muchas gracias, you are super horse."
He stepped down the hill to examine the bodies of the bandits. Both of them looked like they were in their 20s. The moonlight was just bright enough to make out their tattoos by. He could see that one of them had some large numbers tattooed on his neck. Most of the rest of the markings were swirling and geometric patterns. These were obviously crude prison tats. He stripped the men of their rucksacks. The small packs were surprisingly heavy. He looped them over his saddle horn. Then he picked up their guns. He flipped up the one safety lever that had been released. One was a folding stock AK, but the other had a wooden stock. The wooden stock, he saw, had been split and cracked, pierced by 2 bullets from Andy's SIG. Neither of the guns had slings, so Andy pulled a hank of OD parachute cord from his left saddlebag and quickly cut off 2 4-foot lengths. He tied them on as makeshift slings. Andy slung both AKs across his back. Then he inserted Prieto's bit, saddled him, and removed the hobbles. He walked north for 200 yards. leading the horse through the dense trees and up onto level ground. Based on the setting moon's position, he judged the time to be about 3 or 4.